I thought I'd begin with just a very few words about an aspect of the Buddhist teachings that is so simple that it's almost always overlooked. So I'll just say a few words about that and then open it to just questions and discussion that might be of interest to you. The Buddha made one very simple and somewhat obvious statement that I think we don't really pay attention to. He said that whatever we frequently think about or reflect upon will become the inclination of our minds. Whatever we frequently think about or reflect upon will become the inclination of our minds. But I wonder how often we really stop and look at what we frequently think about and reflect upon. I think more usually, more typically, we're just caught in the momentum, you know, of our life story and conditioning and habits. We're just kind of letting our life unroll. And it's not so often that we actually turn our attention inward and start paying attention to the kinds of thoughts, to the kinds of reflections that we're giving energy to. And yet, those thoughts or reflections that occur again and again begin to have power. They become the inclination of our mind. They start directing how our life unfolds. And so, in some way, we can say this is the reason or rationale or basis for meditative training. It's really a way of understanding what our hearts and minds are doing. Because if we don't understand, then we're just acting out of old habits. And when we do understand, when we have a clarity about what's arising, then it's possible to make choices. And there can really be a wise discernment. Yes, these patterns are helpful, they're skillful. They help me, they help others. These patterns are not skillful. They cause harm to myself or others. Without awareness, we don't have the power to make those choices. And so often we live in a kind of confusion. I first began meditation practice, as Paul mentioned, when I was in the Peace Corps. I was young, just 21 years old, in the Far East for the first time. It was all very exotic. I was teaching English in Bangkok. And I was going through these discussion groups where there was an Indian and an English monk leading groups for Westerners. And I had studied philosophy in college and just went through these groups asking hundreds of questions. People stopped coming to the groups because I came. And I'm sure you've all been in groups like that. So I think it was out of some desperation that one of the monks said to us, why don't you try meditating? And again, it was all completely new to me. I didn't know, nothing about Buddhism and meditation. So I was interested, excited. So I got my pack and everything together, and he gave me the basic instructions, and I sat down, and I set my alarm clock for 5 minutes. So I didn't want to sit too long. Something amazing happened in that first 5 minutes, and it wasn't that it was any great enlightening experience. What happened, which is what probably has happened to all of you at one point or another, I saw even in those first 5 minutes that there was a way to look into the mind as well as looking out through it. And up until that point, I was just looking out into the world really without much knowledge of what was looking. And meditation was just a turning in place. But as I say, it wasn't that there was any huge insight in those first 5 minutes, except that light transforming one. That there was a way to look in as well as a way to look have that glimpse, then the whole path of awareness and insight and growing wisdom unfolds for us. That's really the tremendous value of meditative discipline. So if there's any questions you have, either about meditation or the Buddhist teachings,
one question is two parts of this question. The first one is about personal boundaries and right action. And the second part of the question is, can you actually use anger in a skillful way, or is it always a defilement? Just to be looking at why the question's actually arisen in the mind. It's kind of really testing, but I haven't practiced it for a while, and in the past, in that kind of situation, I've just reacted with anger. Since I live in an area where there's restricted parking, and I still have that over the last 3 months, one of my neighbors kept blocking me. So, you know, I come out and I think, okay, so this happened every day over the course of about 3 months. And so the thought came to my mind, and then, you know, okay, you know, it's pretty obvious that it's inconvenient to me, and they keep doing it. Why do I need to do it? And I also then talked to monks, and this was disturbing me in my mind, and there was a lot of suffering because of the anger. And I heard about it, so maybe everyone said that if someone shoots an arrow towards you, it's not the arrow that causes you the suffering, it's your mind. So the question that came to my mind, if someone's actually shooting an arrow, can I actually stop the arrow?
Can you actually?
Can I actually prevent them shooting the arrow if I'm able to? Because in all the talks I've heard so far, you know, lectures, all these kinds of things, they say maintain a personal boundary and also, you know, look within. But the thing is, no one actually talks about a skillful method of maintaining your own boundaries. So in the example that I just gave you, the way the issue was actually resolved was, after a period of 3 months, I actually walked to the door and had to kind of gear up the anger, because with the practice you start to get really, you know, it's a defilement, you know, the judgment in mind, you know, I don't want to, you know, get into anger, blah blah blah, all this kind of stuff. And suddenly I had to bring up that tape, jog it up. You know, you might be like me, and then actually speak with anger and say, don't do this. And it stopped. So my question is, for a monastic, I can actually understand why someone like Ajahn Sumedho would say, if someone's shooting an arrow at you.
In other words, the question is there any, is there ever a skillful place for anger?
Yes,
I think there is a skillful place for what one Tibetan monk called wrathful compassion, where you look like you're angry, you are strong in your energy. But I'm not saying that what I'm suggesting is easy. This is not easy to do, but it's possible. Where we can be strong in situations, you know, and determined and set boundaries. If you can learn the art of doing that, and at the same time having the heart equanimous, that would be. Because if our heart is filled with hatred, even though you may get the desired result, you're actually causing suffering for yourself in the moment and planting seeds of a kind of hardness that So you might get an immediate benefit, but a more lasting harm. So the art would be to see if we can let go of the inner hatred, the inner anger, and then pretend. And sometimes that's necessary. I'll just tell you a story. It's of the Japanese Zen master Suzaki Roshi, who is now over 100 years old and still teaching. And he's a fierce old Zen master. He's like from the old school. They had a monastery. They built this monastery up on the mountaintop in Mount Boulder, California. When they first moved in, some of the local pups would come up and really be bothering them. You know, and they spoke to them, they tried to, you know, all the things that good Buddhists are supposed to do. But it kept continuing. So after some time of this, Suzaki Roshi told his students, let the air out of the tires. That was the last time they came, huh? Hopefully it was done with great compassion. Yeah, so it's an art, you know, but most importantly, I think we really do have to see what's going on in our own hearts. Then there's a wide range of response we can take. If you stand up, can you hear the questions?
Yeah. So my question kind of falls down from that, but it's a touch different, and I'm giving it a story. It's around trust. And I think it can be very challenging when you're dealing with difficult people to not reciprocate or respond. But if you practice, you can have. And I wonder about the continuation of one's meditation practice in regards to a difficult situation and constantly going out into that difficulty and not seeing any outward change. And if one is meant to just continue to watch, to practice, and possibly even come forth with that wrathful compassion, but even that sometimes is not effective. And what to do at this time, to just trust and continue to practice, or to actually, I don't know, maybe be reactive, or try and really change the situation. I mean, and how to know when one is being complacent versus actually doing spiritual practice. Is that clear?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in a situation like that, of course, you know, not knowing the details, it's a little hard to say this or that. But one of the first things to assess would be whether there is anything you can do to change the situation. Because sometimes there is and sometimes there isn't. One of the great lessons of this world is that we are not in control of it. Lots of things go on that are beyond our ability to influence or to change. And it's precisely that recognition which gives strength to the development of equanimity. Because equanimity is that evenness of mind, or spaciousness of mind, that can hold both pleasant and unpleasant without reactivity. So first you need to see, is there anything I can do? If there is, you know, if you really say, well, there's some course of action that I might be able to take that would make a difference. Again, I would really look to see if you can do that action, even if it's forceful, you know, from as really as loving a place as you can, rather than from a hateful place. There's just another whole side to this, and again, I don't know if this is your particular situation, but it's reminding me of the situation that I went through, and may or may not be analogous. Years ago, this happened maybe 20, 25 years ago, a close friend did something that was, I felt to be a complete betrayal of trust. So it just felt like a knife in my heart. And the feeling of betrayal is a horrible feeling. It's just so painful. And after going through some days or maybe even a couple of weeks of, you know, just thinking about this and going over and over in my mind about it, planning all sorts of counterattacks. My mind went through the whole gamut of response. But at a certain point, I realized how much suffering I was in. So then I got really interested in investigating, well, what's the cause of my suffering? And when I could let go of all that reactivity in my mind, and I looked carefully at what was going on inside, I realized that even though it felt like a knife in my heart, for it to hurt, the knife needed some place to land. You know, and that landing was that sense of self, of I. And to the extent that I could see this whole process in accord with my practice and with the basic teachings, that this whole process of mind and body is selfless, I could take the self, the I, the ego out of the picture, then it's as if the knife just passes through. And it wasn't suffering, it's just something that happened. You know, and I wasn't at that time personalizing it anymore. And it was amazing to me to see the difference. You know, so all the pain that I was holding and carrying in my reactivity, it was quite amazing. In the moment of really seeing that, all of it dissolved. And what's most interesting is that we have since become extremely friendly. There is a certain lack of trust. So it's not a kind of, you know, naive pretend that this is a person that would never do this. It's just understand, yeah, this is a person who might do that. But that's okay. Once I understood that, I'm perfectly at ease being very friendly with him. It's just that's another piece of his character that I understand. You know, and which causes his own suffering. So again, what you're seeing as a difficult situation, one part of it, seeing if there's anything you can do about it, the other part is seeing what's catching in you that's causing suffering. One very radical statement of the Buddha, which often people get very reactive to because it is so radical. So I'll just throw it out there. I'm leaving tomorrow. We are responsible for 100% of our suffering. That's a hard one. That's really a hard one to understand and to let in. And people come up with all kinds of, you know, extreme examples. And rather than go there in your response, just in terms of think just of your own life experience and the difficulties that come. Nobody makes us feel a certain way. How we feel about things, even very difficult things, is up to us. I mean, the Dalai Lama, of course, is an sorrow and filling with the suffering with Tibetans in Tibet, you know, the Chinese oppression. And yet there's never any expression of hatred or ill will for the Chinese. You know, it's always compassion. How we feel ultimately, even in the most distressing circumstances, is up to us. Nobody makes us feel a certain way. Years ago, I was in a relationship, goes back 20, 25 years, and we were having a little argument, and my friend says to me, she says, "Stop making me feel aversion." And I just started to laugh, which did not help. But it was just such a great remark. Stop making me feel this way. So this is a great lesson for us. Right? But nobody makes us feel a certain way. It's up to us. And we can train ourselves, even in the most difficult circumstances. And it takes training. This is not easy. We can train ourselves to keep an open heart.
Mark? I think there's a very important teaching of the Buddha which really sums this up very well. I mean, in a way that we can all work with, I appreciate the way you said it. And that's the teaching to buy her the bath garment in the seen, just the seen, in the heard, just the heard, in the imagined, just the imagined, in the cognized, just the cognized. And the scripture goes on to say, and their eyes is known their eyes. In other words, our mind, and this comes back to your leading point, the habitual tendencies that we follow, the speculations of what we hear, what we see, what we imagine, what we cognize, we speculate, and our friend here, he speculates, our friend here speculates. It's all in the mind, you're quite clearly saying. But I think I've been making that mantra within my Buddhist practice for about 14 years on a daily basis, just those simple words. And it's they really helped me to live in the world.
Thank you. I mean, that particular discourse of the Buddha is very powerful. In the seen, may there be just the seen, in the heard, just the heard, in the sense, just the sense, in the cognized, just the cognized. Really bringing us back to the bare experience of what happens. But that is, you know, to a large extent, the meditative practice, and it says that the person who heard those words from the Buddha had the distinction in all of the Buddhist stories of the quickest enlightenment. He heard those words. I'll say them once more.
Very puzzled by this whole thing of the I, and particularly in relationships, because I keep thinking, who's going to fall in love? Is it I, or is it the ego, or what? And how does one know one is in love with another when one's got to be lying to so many other people? It's a very naive question, but it's a real one.
It's not a nice question at all. It goes to the heart. It goes to the very heart of the teaching. And we could spend the next 2 hours talking about that question. But I'll try to summarize the response more briefly. First is to understand that within the teachings, there are two levels of reality that are talked about, a conventional level and a more ultimate level. So the conventional or relative level, that's the level in which there is an I, and there is a self, and there is another, and there are these relationships of one being to another. So, for example, when we do loving kindness meditation, and we are wishing may all beings be happy, may all beings be free of suffering, we're talking as a being to beings. That is on the conventional level. On the more ultimate level of experience, we see that the I, or the sense of self, really is a mental construct built up out of, or created out of, certain basic elements. I'll give you an example. I'm going to hold up this cup. On a conventional level, it's a cup. It holds water. I can drink from it. We can describe the great beauty of the plastic, whatever. We look at it through a high-power microscope. Of course, I've never looked through a high-power microscope, so I'm just imagining this. But we would see a completely different reality. There would be no cup. There would be no water. I don't know whether, you know, at some level, if we could see the electrons and protons and subatomic particles, and there's a whole level of reality that's not obvious to a normal perception, in which the relative level really holds no sway at all. And yet, on the relative level, in our ordinary world, this is where we're operating. We use the cup, we drink from it. What's interesting is that the relative level and the ultimate level are not two different things. It's not as if the electrons and protons and whatever are here and cup is here. It's the same reality perceived at different levels. Correct? And so what we do in meditation is learn to perceive this whole mind-body process on all the levels of our experience. On the relative level, where the self and other and relationships and all the emotions of the relationships. So we perceive and act and respond on that level, wisely and skillfully. But we also learn to drop down and perceive this mind-body on a more ultimate level, where all of that other stuff disappears and we're really seeing the mind-body as an energy system, an energy field that's very rapidly changing. You know, there's something which I call NPMs. NPMs are noticings per minute. And conventional, in the conventional world, maybe, you know, just in an ordinary life, I don't know, maybe there are 20 NPMs. I don't know exactly. 20, 30. On the meditative level, there could be hundreds of NPMs, thousands of NPMs. The mind can get so refined that we are picking up the changes that are actually happening very, very rapidly. And so the whole sense of solidity of the mind-body begins to dissolve. We're experiencing it on another level. It doesn't mean that the relative level disappears, because when we're perceiving on that level, we are engaged in the world in a very conventional way. There's no conflict between the two. It's just different levels of perception. The value to the relative level of seeing things on a more ultimate level is that we can begin to then operate on the relative level, as we do mostly in our lives. We can begin to operate on it with less attachment, because we have a very deep understanding that on that more ultimate level, there's not much solid there. So then, as we are engaged, you know, in the world, fully responsively, compassionately, but we do it with less and less clinging. Because we know from a deeper place that nothing really is less than long enough to cling to. The less we cling on the relative world, the less we cling in relationships, the less we suffer. And that really is what all of the teachings come down to. When the Buddha was asked what he teaches, it's not a metaphysics, it's not a philosophy. He said, I teach about suffering and the end of suffering. You know, so it's a wholly pragmatic practice. Learning to see what in our lives is the cause of suffering and can we let go of those causes. So just to take it one step further, which could be an interesting experiment. For most people, the feeling of love, of being in love, of loving. For most people, these feelings are very intertwined, very almost inextricably intertwined with attachment. And it's almost impossible to imagine really loving someone without attachment. You know, they become so intermingled. It's very interesting to actually look carefully in one's experience, not to have this a theoretical discussion, but to really look in one's experience. I know when I examine the feeling, when I'm feeling most loving, when that's the feeling that's up, what I experience is a kind of openness of heart, a kind of, it's an energy going out, wanting the other person to be happy, to be well. You know, so it's that mood. When I look carefully at what I'm feeling when I'm most attached to somebody, the energy is completely the opposite. The energy is a holding on. So when I saw that for the first time, it was startling to me. Because I saw that attachment, first of all, is just the opposite of loving. You know, one is an outward giving, generosity, and another is a holding. And then I also saw that the attachment doesn't in any way enhance the feeling of love. It doesn't add anything to it. It just adds fear, possessiveness, and a whole host of things. So, as natural as it seems to have these two intermingled, I would just invite you to really look in your life, you know, and in your experience of these two, and see if it's possible, at first even to discern clearly the difference. And then to say, well, could it be possible to be completely loving without attachment? What would that be like? Oops. It's something to look at.
My question is sort of related to this issue of suffering and how we are with it. And I guess what I'm struck by is the experiential, visceral quality of suffering, and that when we sit, we are often, especially given the lifestyle most of us have, we're in complete opposition to what's going on around us, which is constant movement to escape from and numbing from the suffering. So what can happen when we sit can be this very powerful, visceral experience of woundedness. And this relates to the metta as well, which I've experienced in retreats where, for a lot of people, it's almost too much. And so I'm really interested to hear how we negotiate with that kind of really in the body, physiological sense in relation to our mindfulness practice?
That's another good question. Often people who don't know much about meditation, you know, may have the idea that, oh yes, come sit, be a nice vacation, a bliss trip. This kind of meditation is not, maybe for some others at all. It really is an opening to the totality of our experience, a lot of which we're distracted from, a lot of which is covered, and the practice of meditation really is an opening to many aspects of our energy system, of our psyche, of our emotions, of our past history, that really start coming to the surface. And for some people, there may be a lot of painful material, you know, that starts to surface and that we're really looking at sometimes for the first time. You know, maybe it's stuff we're somewhat familiar with, but in the silence and undistractedness of the meditation retreat, it becomes very vivid and can be very intense. So I would just say two things in terms of managing that process. One is the skillful use of the loving-kindness meditation, which is its own practice, and using it a lot, especially directing it towards oneself. It really softens the heart. And it helps create a kind of inner emotional balance, which allows for the looking, the more difficult material. So I definitely encourage that kind of practice. The other thing that's really important, and this is particularly true, I would say, in an extreme case for people who have experienced different trauma in their life, and there are people who come to meditation with some pretty, pretty powerful traumas, you know, one kind or another, and meditation gives access to it. But often it's like a floodgate opening. And so one of the skills that's really needed in working with it, and I've worked a lot with people on this, is learning how to titrate the speed at which things come up. Because very often people have the sense, I'm going to go into this, I'm going to get to the bottom of it, you know, in charge. It's just the wrong attitude. It has to be very slow, very gentle. People have to learn how to back off, come back to some place that feels safe, and just to let it come up in very manageable quantities. That's its own learning skill. You know, and in working with a teacher can help somebody just to slow the whole thing down, so then the material comes up in a way that can be handled and processed. And that's really the process of freeing myself from it. It's a delicate process, you know, and it needs to be here.
You spoke about an arrow being hitting you and dealing with it in an equanimous way. From my experience, the first thing that happens is a closing down as opposed to an opening of the heart. And I just wondered if you could sort of give step by step, or just talk more about the whole process of getting from that point to the point where your heart can be open.
I didn't mean to suggest that for most of us, it's an immediate process of opening, because sometimes it's a very gradual process. You know, some kind of arrow strikes us, something painful happens, and we think it's a very simple analogy in physical pain, and it has its analog in emotional pain as well. When we feel physical pain, what's the first reaction? Very rarely do we say, oh, good. Let me open to this, let me feel it. Now, usually the first reaction is, I hate this. And, you know, what can I do to get away from it, or to resist it, or to tighten it, or to tense it? tends to distract ourselves, we do a whole lot of strategies to avoid pain. Just as a little aside, I'll tell you one of my favorite stories. A friend of mine told a story of his father and his grandfather driving in a car on December 7th, 1941, which is Pearl Harbor Day. So, in the States, you've got to move on Pearl Harbor. Okay, so his grandfather and his father are in the car. The news comes on the radio. And the first thing his grandfather says to his father is, "Don't have your mother." World War II would be a big one to keep out. Okay, we don't wanna open to this one. It's a funny story. But it's not so far from what we do on a much smaller scale. It's not easy to open to suffering, whether it's physical pain or emotional pain. So the first step in the process is recognizing that it's there. So we're undistracted enough to actually see and recognize, yeah, there's some pain in the body, or there's some emotional distress. And whatever it is, the first step is recognizing. If we don't recognize that it's there, it's impossible to begin the process of opening to it. The second step, and this is really a crucial one, not only for times of difficulty, but this is a technique or method or suggestion that can be used throughout meditation, no matter what it is that's happening, is to ask the question, what's the attitude in my mind about what's happening? Because we can recognize the pain, we can recognize the difficult emotion, but we might not be recognizing the attitude we have about it, which could be aversion or dislike or judgment or fear. There could be a lot of attitudes about it which keep us from opening to it. And those attitudes are often unnoticed. So we need to ask that question once we recognize the painful situation. What's the attitude in my mind? What's interesting is that very often we don't need an answer to that question. So it's not always that we ask the question, what's the attitude in my mind about this? And then we have to sort out, oh, what is my attitude? I'm not sure. Very often, it's simply asking the question, which is enough to bring the mind into a more neutral space regarding it. So I'll give you a very simple example of the potency of this question. There are times when I'm meditating, and I'm just feeling my breath. Very simple. Just breathing in, breathing out. Simple. And my mind feels calmness, my mind feels calm. And then occasionally I'll ask the question, oh, what's my attitude right now? What's feeling like that? And just by asking the question, very often I will feel a relaxation from some kind of wanting that I didn't even know was there. You know, particularly feeling the breath, just the slightest leaning into wanting more peace, wanting more calm, wanting to get more concentrated, wanting something. And then on a very subtle level, it can be just a slight leaning. Simply by asking a question, what's the attitude? The mind releases from it. So you can use that even with much bigger areas of distress. So first is recognition. The second is checking the attitude in order to come to a place of acceptance. And acceptance is what is really the key. So let's share with you another story in this regard. Now, each of us was conditioned quite differently with respect to predominant emotions and the particular emotional strains that we have. For me, over the years of my practice, especially in the earlier years, and also going back into my life, I worked a lot with fear. Fear was a very strong emotion, and it's very unpleasant. You know, I saw it come up in so many different situations. Once in my practice, the fear, this was an intensive meditation, the fear was so strong that I was afraid to actually go from sitting position to standing. I mean, it was primal, it, you know, completely irrational. There was nothing there to be afraid of. And yet, for some reason, that's what was coming up, this overwhelming feeling of fear. And this was going on. I was on a long, intensive retreat, and I'm being mindful of it, and noting fear. But nothing seemed to really unhook it. And one day I was doing some walking meditation outside, back and forth, and the fear was so strong, and something shifted in my mind. And that shift was expressed in the thought, if this fear is here for the rest of my life, it's okay. And that was the first moment in all of those weeks that I had truly accepted it. I recognized it, I knew it was there, I was thought I was being mindful, I was noting it, but it was also it would go away. It was only when I got to that place, if it's here for the rest of my life, it's okay. It's amazing. In that moment, that whole mass of fear washed through. It's not that fear never comes again, but the relationship to it has changed completely. Now it really is okay. It's just another emotion. It's an unpleasant one, but so what? So it's the recognition, it's seeing the attitude towards it, it's the acceptance. These are the steps. And it's powerful because we are so conditioned and limited by our identification with certain emotional patterns, and to be able to step out of them into that spaciousness where we see emotion. The image that I like to use a lot for the awareness of the emotion, it's really like clouds in the sky. You know, different conditions form, the clouds form, and then conditions change, and the clouds disappear. Can our minds be like the sky? Where the emotions come out of conditions, they're not permanent, they're not fixed, and they're not self. Simply an experience arising out of conditions. Conditions change, the emotions change. So can we learn how to be accepting and feeling of them all without rooting them? In the sense of, this is my emotion, it belongs to me, I hate it, I like it, whatever. So there's a lot. I mean, the meditation opens up a whole new world with regard to how we relate to emotions. We have 3 minutes till tea. That's only in England.
It was mentioned in the introduction about Goenka. And I know just being here today, there'll be something, many things that you say that will inspire me and stay with me. And I'm sure many people in this room would have benefited from Goenka's teachings, maybe through tapes on retreat. So I'm just wondering, maybe it's from your first-hand personal experience, maybe what are some of the things that you hear Goenka now, and hear that name, what it evokes in you, and what maybe comes to mind, so just what stays with you.
For those of you who don't know, Goenkaji was one of my early teachers, not my first teacher. think this is a very particular method of Vipassana. There are over 50 different ways of doing Vipassana practice. So there are many, many approaches to the development of mindfulness and awareness. And Goenka teaches one particular approach, and he likes people to stay, to really be committed to that approach and not to mix, you know, different practices. I just have a total respect and appreciation for him. Even though myself, I badly, he's teaching a lot and benefited tremendously. My temperament kind of likes to bring in lots of different things. So in the end, that way of practice was not suitable after some time. For the time that I did it, it was really valuable. And I don't think there is a right and wrong approach to this. I think depending on our own temperaments and inclinations, for some people, staying with one clearly defined path is exactly the right thing to do. Because there's no confusion, there's no doubt, you know what you're supposed to do, you do it and you go to the end. For other people, maybe their minds are such that they like to draw in elements from different. And so other approaches might be helpful. So I don't have any, I have tremendous respect and appreciation for the whole spectrum. And then we each find our own particular way of unfolding. He's a very powerful teacher. I think, we should take a tea break now because we've got a serving and set this time aside. So we can get to that quarter.